This is the No Dogma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Mads Torgersen, lead designer of C# and a program manager at Microsoft. Thank you very much for taking time out of your evening once again, Mads.
Thanks for having me here again. I feel like we're approaching an anniversary or something.
I looked at it a moment ago. You have come on to talk about C# 7, 8, 9, 10, and now we're going to talk about C# 11.
But that's a great streak.
For people who haven't heard those episodes, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Yeah, so I'm this Danish dude who works for Microsoft, and I've been through sheer luck and serendipity. I'm now the lead designer for this programming language, C#, and have been so for a good half decade or so.
I think in previous episodes we actually talked about how you became the designer, and why there's such a number of language designers from Denmark. So people can certainly look up those ones. Mm-hmm. If you were to describe what you do, how would you describe it?
Well, I'm the only person who's paid full time to evolve C#. So that consists of a lot of meetings and like notably, we have the venerable language design meeting twice a week with a bunch of good people. And then I spent time working on proposals and also interacting with, partners in the company that we need to work together with for various things. And, you know, it's a lot of it is not, technical in the traditional sense of sitting in front of Visual Studio and writing code. Actually, that's the least of it, probably. It's much more, if it's technical, it's more about writing out the proposals, making sure that all the details fit.
I had to look back at our notes from C# 10, that episode in part one. We do talk about a lot of the design process, the teams involved, the relationships between you and various teams. So again, we're not going to cover that tonight, but if mm-hmm. someone wants to look it up, it's in Mads Torgersen C# 10 part one from a year ago.
That might be useful for me to check out and see if I'm still doing it. If I'm still doing it well.
So C# 11. When is C# 11 coming out?
It's coming out in November. I think November 8 is the date, but don't kill me if I'm wrong. So it's as of this recording, it's a few weeks out.
Yeah, so we're end of October now.
Yeah,
but you have previews have been available for quite some time.
Yeah, and we have the general policy now with the language that we trickle out the features as we are building them. So they essentially, if you use the lang version preview in C#, using the production C# compiler, you will get extra language features that are, some version of the features that are on the way. And, in certain instances of features, of versions of features that don't make it into the final language. So we had one glorious example of that in this release cycle where we released a feature that we knew would be somewhat controversial. We released it very early in preview so that we could get lots of feedback on it. And based on the feedback, we ended up pulling the feature. So yeah, if you want to play with new language features, generally put the preview language version on. Right now, I guess, is not the good time because we're just releasing, so there aren't any non-ship ones in there yet, as far as I know. But, over the next year, they'll start trickling in.
The one you're referring to that got pulled, is that the one null checks on methods, parameters being passed to methods?
Parameter null checking, yeah.
So in that case, were you at a point that the work was done and you decided people don't want it, or there was a lot more work to do and people don't want it, so there's not much point continuing?
The work was pretty much done. I think when it comes to core implementation effort, it was done. There were probably, we could probably have firmed up, fixed more bugs, and there were certainly more like tooling features that we could have done, offering more refactorings to go one way or the other, that kind of stuff. There was definitely more to do. But in terms of full functionality of the feature itself, it was there.
So then what's the, if it isn't a significant expense to continue and ship it, and it adds something but doesn't take away something, why pull it from a language?
Well, the thing is, we can't really shrink C Sharp. And so everything we put in does take something away. Like, it spends surface area budget in a way. Like, we're always, whenever you add something to the language, it's there forever, and it adds to the complexity of the full language. So, you know, Anders used to say, every feature comes with minus 100 points. So just putting in a feature, it has to overcome the minus 100 points with value. And this one, we were uncertain of that. In this case, there was also, it's not always just that it isn't valuable enough. With this one, there were also genuine disagreements and, you know, really good arguments on both sides of it, that about how the feature should be done, in particular the syntax, but also to some degree the semantics. And so if we end up doing a feature in a way that many people don't think is the right way to do the feature, then it becomes really hard to do it the other way later. So you're making a big commitment. You can't just keep putting different versions of the same feature in until everybody has their version. So that was an aspect here as well. Don't burn the syntax, don't burn this feature if you're not absolutely sure it's a winner. Put it back on the shelf, see if we get to clarity in a couple of years on that, and then maybe pull it back out.
Okay, gotcha. I was going to get to that it may come back in a different form, in a different syntax at some point.
Yeah, I mean, nothing's banned forever. Yeah. It's except maybe making semicolons optional, but who knows? You might play this audio back at me 5 years from now.
Yeah. Switch to indentation instead of brackets. Well, as an interesting point, when it comes to the final decision of inclusion or exclusion, is that your call?
In a way, yes. In a way, as long as I do a good job of it. Obviously, I report to people at Microsoft, and also I don't build the compiler myself. I rely on Microsoft being willing to put in the majority of the resources that go into building it. There's definitely significant help from the community as well. So I can't just go rogue. I need to make sure the organization is with me. But that said, at the end of the day, I'm the one who says, okay, we'll do it like this. I try very hard not to exercise that as a power, though. I mean, we're a group of people designing C#, and I try to take that very seriously and reach a point where everyone feels that the decision that ends up being made was, even if they don't agree with it, that it was made in the right way, that it took everything into consideration, and that they just happened to be in a, they happen to be in disagreement with the majority, and they can live with what we do. Like, so I try very hard to reach a point where I don't have to put my foot down and say, nope, we're doing it like this.
I have a note from a few episodes back where you called yourself a reluctant dictator.
Yes, I'm very reluctant. There has to be, I think, in these situations, someone at the end of the table. But it's good also if that person is a little uncomfortable being at the end of the table, because these decisions that we make, and you know, it depends very much on the domain, I think, how impactful decisions are. But every decision we make in C# is essentially forever. So we have to really be diligent. We have to be humble towards that responsibility, and kind of, you know, flying by the seat of our pants is not a good strategy for this kind of thing. So you have to not just say, let's do this and let's do that. We have to really think it through, and being reluctant to go against like a lot of strong opinion, for instance, is a good thing.
When you say, you know, it has to be forever, do you see C# 15, 20, 25, you know, over the next 15, 20 years, whatever it happens to be, continuing and progressing for that length of time?
Yeah, actually, I think I do.
C has been around a really long time, of course, as many languages.
Yeah, and some languages that have been around for a long time end up standing very still, and it's possible that we will, but so far, the general evolution in the programming language kind of state of the art in the changes in the kinds of domains that we program for and so on, they happen quickly enough that it's sort of either follow along as best we can, modulo what I just said before about being cautious, or essentially, give it 5 or 10 years, you start kind of becoming stagnant and you stop being a technology that will be people's first choice for their next thing. And we've sort of made the decision early on, way back in the Anders days, that we want to, as long as this circus keeps going, we want to try to be a lot of people's first choice for the next project. We want to try to stay in the game as a serious contender. And it's surprising to me even how well we managed to integrate whole new concepts into C# without, in my opinion, breaking it up into sub languages or kind of smothering it. One of the things that we try very hard to do is for new things, give them the time to get the shape that lets them fit in really well with what's already there, with the minimum sort of overhead, not just in terms of syntax, but also in terms of concept count. So with that, I think that we're like, take a thing like pattern matching. I think you said we've been talking since C#7. That was the first version of C# that had pattern matching. Before that, it wasn't a thing. And every version since then, we've been improving and expanding on pattern matching. But it's a whole new concept in C# that we've just taken our time, one pattern at a time, to fit in really super well with what's already there in the language, rather than try to sort of graft on a new thing that you have to sort of start over to use.
And then everything, of course, is backward compatible all the way back to C#1.
Yeah, we've decided to have a very high bar on compat. Back in the old .NET framework days, we didn't really have a choice on that because we had no say in what version of .NET was running on people's machines, and they would be only one, so it better work. Yeah. Now we have more leeway, and we are using it a little more. We are taking more liberties, but by and large, we are still taking compat very seriously. We're certainly not removing features.
Actually, you made a comment there that the old .NET framework days, but .NET framework is still a very important thing. Does its existence, as opposed to .NET 6, 7, 8 that are coming, in any way hinder the language?
We made some good decisions so that it doesn't. Essentially, new language features are not supported on older runtimes. They may work, but they're not supported. So we take the freedom to add new things to the core libraries, to the BCL, to add new things even to the runtime, and target those from the languages. And essentially, if we try to compile against an older runtime that doesn't support the things you're using, you'll just get an error saying, "Hey, that you can't do that here." So, and that really helps us not being held back by the existence of older things out there, including .NET Framework.
Yeah. I will turn us to C#11. There are some new and some non-preview features. So I remember a year ago when we were talking about C#10, you were very excited about the generic math, but it was in preview at the time. And now it's whatever not preview is.
Yes. And I'm still excited. A whole year later, I'm still excited. So this is one that this was the first feature we put in preview from C#11. it was in preview in the release of C Sharp 10, a whole full year before. And even before that, there had actually been various previews of it. The language version of it actually has very little to do with math, the language side of this. This is a collaboration across, in particular, the language and the core libraries, where we said, there are many things that are most naturally expressed as static methods or static members. One of them is operators. Operators are static members in the way that you operate overloading in C# and .NET. And you can't, or you couldn't, well, until November 8, you can't abstract over static things in official C#, right? There's just, you can't say, well, you should have a plus operator, or you should have a static factory called create, and then override that or implement that in some, further down. There's no virtuals at the static level. And that in particular has been a hindrance for math, because almost everything you do is an operator. And if you can't write code that's abstracted over the specific type that you're doing it on, well, you can't write numeric algorithms in a generic fashion. You have to copy paste still in this day and age. So that's a really, for people who are trying to do math on .NET, that's been one of the hardest things, one of the biggest hurdles to get over. So what we did in conjunction with putting the language feature, so the language feature is an interface can now have static virtual or static abstract members, methods, properties, and operators. And then implementing classes have to provide those implementations for those statics. And on the library side, we created a whole family of interfaces representing math, representing essentially which operators do you have, and concepts such as having a neutral elements and zero and that kind of stuff. So there's a whole like model of math or of operators as a family of interfaces that all have these static virtual members in them, or static abstract members. And then we went and implemented them on all of our math types, including all the primitive types, but they're also open for everyone else to implement. So now we sort of unlocked a whole potential ecosystem of people writing their own math types and people writing on the one side, fitting, plugging into that. And on the other side, people writing generic algorithms that do math abstracted from the specific types involved. So while that's not the only scenario that you can use static virtual members for, it's the one that we really leaned into from the beginning. Said, let's do the library work at the same time as we do the language work and develop those two in conjunction with each other.
And you were saying it was in preview for C# 10. So has the work on this feature advanced in the last year?
Yeah, it has. There were definitely things missing in the preview version. It tried to sort of hit the core scenarios. We learned things about the language feature itself. For instance, we started out with them just being abstract, and then we did the work to allow default implementations on static virtual members. We also added some other smaller language features to complete the math picture. So for instance, you can now declare checked versions of user-defined operators. So you can say, I have both a plus and I have a checked plus side by side. And then if this operator gets called in a checked context, then it'll pick the checked one instead of the unchecked one. So little things like that, loosening up the requirements and some other operators, made it so that we could model the math better.
And then were you getting feedback from users that were using that preview in real applications?
Yeah, we've gotten feedback, a lot of feedback from users, and some of them were working with in math settings already and gave us some input on it. So there was a lot of excitement in some of those communities for sure.
And then you were saying how, you know, people can create their own libraries. Are there people out there creating them and sharing them to make it be reusable for others?
I haven't seen so much of that yet, but we also haven't shipped yet. So probably it needs a year or two to start percolating.
I'll move us on to our next one. The list patterns is another new feature in C Sharp.
Oh, 11. Yeah, that's, you know, I mentioned pattern matching before and how we keep adding new patterns. So this is one, this is sort of like a, so pattern matching originates with functional programming languages. And we've had to really strongly adapt patterns and the notion of patterns to things that are useful and make sense in more of an object-oriented setting. And list patterns are sort of the canonical pattern from functional programming. Lists there are sort of classically, at least, they're implicitly linked lists, and you will pattern match into them by picking off with the front. You know, you get the first three elements, and then you can grab the rest of the list and work with those elements separately in a pattern. So we wanted to do something like that, but that fits more with also with being less sort of directional, being less focused on picking off from the front first. So a list pattern, essentially you have a pair of square brackets, and inside you can have comma separated patterns that apply to the elements at that position. And at exactly, or at up to one place inside of there, you can put a, what we call a slice pattern. So you can say dot, dot, and then you're talking about everything in the middle of variable length. And then you can optionally match that into its own variable as well, apply a pattern to, you know, whatever set of elements was left between what you picked off at the front and what you picked off at the back of the list. And then this pattern applies to all kinds of types that we essentially reused the concepts from C# 8 when we had index and range added to the language. There's this notion of a type being indexable and countable and sliceable, and we reuse those notions to describe what a type needs to offer in order for you to be able to use list patterns on them. And in some cases, I mean, sometimes you can use a list pattern against the type, but you can't use the slice part of it because it doesn't offer a capability for slicing out the middle part. So, there's sort of like a certain structure, a certain set of members that if a type offers those, then you can do list patterns on them.
So what would be the common types that would support, let's say, the majority of those features?
So definitely the library types like list of T, arrays, that kind of thing, immutable, this or that, immutable list, immutable. Anything where you can ask about the number of elements, where you can index, and if you want a slicing pattern, where it offers a capability, like essentially a method called slice that lets you grab a sublist, if you will, then patterns will work over it. We're talking about possibly for the next version of C# to broaden it out more and allow even things that don't have an obvious way to get the count, like IEnumable, essentially, all the things that link would work on. But it's still up for debate whether we would, you know, we would do the expensive way of counting, for instance, or whether we would just only let you pick off of the front, or, you know, things like that. So there's an open design question there. So we're looking at expanding what can be targeted with the list pattern. But for now, we just did the sort of the 80% scenario of just lists and arrays and collection types.
I'll include a link to it because I'm having trouble visualizing what the pattern, the matching would look like, because what you're describing kind of sounds like a regular expression to me, but I'm assuming it's easier to use in a regular expression.
Yeah, and it's very strongly compile time checked. So one of the nice things about using patterns instead of using if-then-else style logic is that the patterns get checked very strongly. Like if you put one pattern after another, and the compiler will do its best to determine that there is still something left for the second pattern to pick up. Like if it's completely subsumed, as we call it, by the previous pattern, you'll get an error saying, hey, you can't get here. And if your pattern doesn't cover every possible value of the input type, it'll give you a warning saying, hey, some things might fall through here, and we'll even try to tell you and give you an example of a value that wouldn't be caught by any of the cases in a switch that applies multiple patterns. So they're very helpful, not just from a sort of visual perspective. It also gives you stronger compiler feedback, lets you find more bugs like that. And also, because it's more abstracted, it lets us be more efficient in terms of what code we actually generate underneath when we're doing like a multi-pattern switch. We can make sure we evaluate things only once, that we only evaluate them when we need them, and so on. So it abstracts away the implementation choices in a good way, that the compiler can write code that either you couldn't have written or that would be very ugly to look at if you did, even more ugly than straight up if analysis.
The comment you made there that you'll get feedback on things that the pattern might miss, is that coming from the compiler or is that from tooling in the likes of Visual Studio?
That's from the compiler itself.
Okay.
We want to give you as much benefit as possible from this. So yeah, the compiler just straight up won't let you compile if you have a case that can't be hit.
Another new feature, and this one I've been hoping for years, is raw string literals. You mind introducing those?
Well, yeah, they're awesome. So you might say, does C# really need yet another form of string literals? And I say,
yes.
Hell yes. Hell yes.
Try working with JSON in C# and you'll see why.
Yeah. So essentially, when you have something that you could even very loosely classify as code, you know, strings with many special symbols in them, you're just in hell, because many of those symbols will need to be escaped in current C# strings. Even in, you know, when you use verbatim strings, backslashes still escape, you know? So we were like, let's add the string literal to end all string literals, the ultimate form of string literal that simply does not have any escapes. There are no escapes in a raw string literal. Anything you put in there is content, verbatim content. And so that means you can take your JSON or your XML or your C++ code or whatever, your regular expression. yes. And you can stick them in there directly, copy paste. And the way that you delimit them is by three double quotes. So you put three double quotes in the beginning and then three double quotes in the end. And now, of course, people can start. I sort of imagine this dialogue all the time, because then people will be like, but what if there are three consecutive double quotes in the thing that you're copy pasting? And we're like, yeah, then this won't work. But we let you use four double quotes or five double quotes or six double quotes, as long as you end with the same number that you start with. And so that means that there, for every kind of trick people can come up with to try to beat it, there are ways that do not involve putting escapes inside, essentially. So they can also be interpolated. And then, of course, you need curly braces. And what if you want curly braces in content? And I'm not going to try to explain in audio. But again, there are tricks so that you can have both curly braces and interpolation inside of the same raw string literal. One final trick we have with them is that whenever you quote something like code, or you typically want, very often you don't want to have leading white space in there. But if you have leading white space, then you can then you can take a multi-line literal and you can flush it into where the rest of the code around it is. And that then your code containing the literal looks nice, but now you have all this space inside of your literals. And if you flush it out to the left edge, well, now it looks ugly. So so that problem we're also addressing in raw string literals by essentially we cut out leading space from every line up until where the end terminator is, where the triple double quotes at the end are. They essentially become a slider. Wherever you put those, and in sort of horizontally, that determines where, you know, everything to the left of that, that's white space that gets cut out of your raw string literal. So now you can, if you want to have everything indented to where the rest of your code is, the surrounding code is, you can do so. And then you just use the end terminator to say how much, if any, white space you want in front of every line in your literal.
I remember when this was coming out some months ago and I was trying it out and it was, it works. I can now have a JSON string and do interpolation and I don't have to do any crazy tricks like I was doing in the past. And the scenario that I've had years ago was I was using an infrastructure as code tool and it was deploying to a cloud and that cloud was using JSON for configuration and I needed to substitute stuff in. And it was hideous. I had ways of working with it with Newtonsoft and the various kind of navigation of the JSON objects, but this is so much easier.
Yeah, it is. You know, once you try this, you'll never go back. And yeah, there's no reason to.
When you do look at it initially, you see a lot of brackets and you're kind of going, I thought there would only be one and there are three. But once you kind of get over that or four or five, it then works. So there is, you can't simply come along and paste the JSON in and then do your interpolation. You do need to account for the number of brackets that you need within that JSON.
Yeah. I mean, there has to be some way for us to, there has to be some way for you to delineate a hole. And if we don't want to, like an interpolation hole, and if we don't want to compromise on escapes, then there has to be a way for you to say, you know, yeah, you have three open brackets next to each other in the content that you want to quote. Well, then you need to have at least four brackets to delineate your holes, because otherwise, you know, how can you tell them apart? And the way you then tell the compiler that it should look for four brackets for an interpolation hole is that you put not one, but four dollar signs in the beginning. That's essentially where you tell it to, you know, what to look for when it's looking for interpolation holes. And if then sees five brackets inside, well, then the outermost ones are part of the content and the innermost four, you know, delineate the hole. So it all kind of composes, but you have to get into that mindset.
Yeah, and you do still need to make your string correct, have the balance of brackets in the right spot. So it's not trivial. You can make a mistake, but with a good kind of find and replace strategy, you know, it will work, and it will work a lot better than it used to.
Yeah, and if you use a good editor like in Visual Studio, the colorization will really help you, because you can look at those brackets and you see, well, that one is in red, so that's part of the content, and that one's in black, so that's part of the code. You can literally like just look at it and see, okay, here's code, here's content at a glance.
And then another new feature is new required members.
Yeah. Well, actually, let me say something about couple of the previous ones we talked about, both the raw string literals and the list patterns before. One thing that I actually really, truly love about those features is that they both came about with very significant contribution from the community, from people who do not work for Microsoft, who went in and were very strongly engaged in the design and did in some cases, the most heavy lifting on the implementation of the feature as well. Implementation is always a team effort, and the compiler team at Microsoft is always involved, but we're starting to see more and more where significant parts of the language are are contributed and where both design and implementation are contributed from the community. And that is really, really great.
No, it's very, yeah, it's very impressive, because if I had the skills to do something like the string literals, I would have been involved, but I know my level of capability isn't down at the compiler, so not my kind of thing, but it's fantastic that people are doing that.
Yeah, even if you're not a compiler person, you know, you can get involved in design, and the amount of the sheer number of people who contribute in various ways on the C Sharp design repo, the .NET C Sharp Lang GitHub repo, is astounding. Like we get a lot, you know, small and big contributions. Lots of people just, you know, point something out, come with a great example, or ask for a little twist, and that'll, you know, percolate all the way to becoming part of the language.
Nice. Okay to talk about new required members?
Yeah. Yeah, it's we almost have to. They're required. So we've been, so there's another one of those. So pattern matching is one of those journeys that we set out years and years ago on this journey, and we're still on it in the language. Like, there's a little sub theme that keeps chugging along. And another one of those has to do with object construction and object initialization. So back when we started looking at records and did the first set of features that ended up becoming records in C#, we looked at a lot of aspects of how classes and structs are declared for and the interplay between that and the newing up of them. So it dawned on us that actually, a lot of commercial big uses of C# did not essentially mandated trivial constructors only. Like, if you start, if you have, you know, big hierarchies, you have fairly complex object models, and now you're threading, constructors through them, sometimes multiple constructors for convenience, and they have to all link up at every level of inheritance and be just right. And, you know, it's a lot of code for typically only doing a little bit of argument checking and then initializing a bunch of fields. Right. And so it's been a cumbersome part of the language and one that's been brittle to maintain. Sometimes constructors are just a thing, but when they're fairly trivial in behavior, it feels like you're doing a lot of boilerplate code. So we addressed that to some degree with records as part of records, but we also started attacking it from as its own thing, like for all classes and structs, essentially saying, well, what are the ways? Because we have object initializers as an alternative, right? Ever since C#3, instead of having, you know, instead of designing your class so you have three constructor parameters, you could design it so that it has zero of them, and then you use an object initializer to just directly assign into three properties. That's always been available. No, not always, but for a long time. But there are certain downsides with it. And one of them was, well, that only works if the object is mutable, because it's assigning into these properties. So what are you going to do if you want an immutable object model? And we solved that with init-only accessors a couple of releases ago. And we sort of had a checklist of problems that you get if you want to essentially declare your class without a constructor, just use the default one that's there and initialize your object through object initializers. Another problem, and the one that we chose to attack in C# 11 is, well, you can't compel people to initialize all the properties. If you have a parameter list, well, then people have to provide arguments for all the parameters unless they're optional, right? You want to call the constructor? Well, you got to give me those arguments. So you can force people to initialize certain things. And object initializers haven't been like that, right? It's always optional. You just, you know, you want to assign to that thing or not? Well, up to you. So required properties are really just Well, these properties you don't get to not. Like if you don't have an object initializer that initializes the required properties, well, you get a compiler error. You have to. So it really just plugs that hole as well and makes, again, object initializers a more viable alternative to constructors for that situation. It also addresses a problem with that we've had for a couple of releases around nullable reference types, or rather non-nullable reference types, where if you don't have a constructor, if your constructors don't initialize non-nullable properties, well, you get a nice little warning saying, hey, these have the default value in them, and you're not initializing them. So you're kind of breaking null, you're breaking the null rules here. And then there wasn't really a good thing you could tell the compiler to say, no, no, I got it, because you didn't got it, you know? And then you could start like assigning stupid dummy things into your properties just to shut up the warning or turn off the warnings temporarily. But they would all just be bad solutions because you were shutting up a warning, but you still had the problem that the person creating the object was not the person providing the values. So required properties solve that too. If a non-nullable reference property that's required is required, then we do not warn about constructors not initializing them, because we know somebody's going to initialize them. If you don't do it in the constructor, whoever news up the object will be doing it. So it also plugs a hole in the nullable story that we've had for a few years.
That's the end of part one. In part two, Mads will answer listener questions. If you like this episode, check out the other episodes with Mads Torgerson. There's a link in the notes. Or check out episodes 163 and 164 with Jared Parsons on the C# compiler. The opening music was a return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Adagio Azzi by Dan Yan Ki from the album War and Peace.